Given interest rates, limited supply, and the possibility of a coming recession, it's a bit of a weird time to be house shopping. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams, in for Kai Rizdal. It's Thursday, December 29th. Nice to have you with us. The housing market is ending 2022 on a pretty sour note. Home sales in November dipped to their second lowest level since the National Association of Realtors started tracking that stat 20 years ago. And though mortgage rates have dropped a bit in recent weeks, they topped 7% last month and are still way above where they were last year. Add in further expected rate hikes from the Fed and the uncertainty around a possible recession next year, and you've got to ask, who exactly is going to buy a house in 2023? Marketplace's Matt Levin has more.
To be clear, the housing market in Fresno, California is not dead. But compared to last year, when the influx of remote workers from the Bay Area was in full force, the market now is,
I would say, like the tortoise and the hare. So
Sabrina Brown is a local real estate broker. She says she's still getting some calls from certain types of buyers, renters just fed up with renting, newlyweds looking to upsize. And she's noticed a new type of seller, the formerly remote worker.
We have people that are changing jobs. They're saying, no, get back to the office. So we have those people that are selling as well.
But those retetherings of worker to office are pretty rare. People just aren't moving very much these days. And that trend will last well into 2023, says economist Lawrence Yoon from the National Association of Realtors.
Overall annual sales next year will be lower. I think about 7% or 10% decline in overall unit sales.
And that's assuming the Fed wins the inflation fight and doesn't hike rates any higher than anticipated. Yun says while he expects prices nationally to remain flat, some coastal markets like San Francisco may see drops of as much as 15%.
The super expensive markets are always more sensitive to mortgage rate changes.
Of course, all those predictions could change depending on whether the economy lurches into a recession and just how high the unemployment rate goes. Economist Orfe Divongi at Zillow says even if there is an economic downturn,
buyers and sellers are still much better off today than they were before the pandemic.
Buyers are more likely to be sitting on savings, and sellers have built some equity as home prices increase. Divongi says he's actually pretty optimistic about a market rebound, assuming the Fed really does get inflation under control. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a bit of a rebound there as well. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Office of Federal Student Aid has a lot going on right now. It's part of the Department of Education, and its plans for 2023 include managing the resumption of student debt repayments, simplifying the FAFSA form college students use to apply for federal aid, and managing the administration's plan for loan forgiveness, if that withstands challenges in the Supreme Court. With that to-do list, the office asked for more money in the latest spending package and was denied. In the omnibus deal, the budget for the Office of Federal Student Aid remains exactly the same. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has this one.
People who work at the Office of Federal Student Aid stay up late.
It's not uncommon for them to have meetings at 10 o'clock at night.
Betsy Mayotte is president of the Institute of Student Loan Advisors and has been to some of those late night meetings.
There's so many really enormous projects in the air that have very limited timelines to get done, and they're under a lot of pressure to get those done.
Like student loan forgiveness, the Supreme Court will hear challenges in late February that will determine whether tens of millions of borrowers have their debts forgiven. But even if loan forgiveness doesn't happen, just resuming student loan collection this year after it was paused due to COVID will be a project.
The student loan servicing machine was always a very creaky machine.
Matthew Chingos is vice president for education data and policy at the Urban Institute.
They spun this whole system down. They turned it off in March of 2020 at the start of the pandemic. And now they're going to have to start it up again.
Having the same budget means that machine could get even creakier. Scott Buchanan is executive director of the Student Loan Servicing Alliance, a trade association.
Servicing is like any other activity. You get what you pay for.
And with budget limits, there's less room for error, let alone improvements.
All of the things that everyone's looking at in terms of quicker processing time, system upgrades, more live agents on the phone, those things all cost more.
Meanwhile, borrowers have been out of touch during the pandemic, which can make managing payments even harder. Again, Matthew Chingos at the Urban Institute.
Maybe they changed their email address or their phone number, and their servicer in the Department of Education doesn't even have a way to get in contact with them.
Which means people might not realize they owe and could be more likely to default. Jared Bass is Senior Director for Higher Education at the Center for American Progress.
These programs should just work. You know, I think when we all take out loans to go to college, we expect to be able to pay them back.
The Department of Education said in a statement, it'll do everything it can with available resources. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
This holiday season in the UK is coinciding with the country's worst labor unrest in more than a decade. Nurses, junior doctors, train operators, teachers, and border control officials are either taking part in or planning strikes. They're all demanding pay increases that at least match Britain's current level of inflation, 10.7%, and the nurses want 19% raises. But the British government has dismissed the demands. It says large pay hikes like that would wreck public finances and raise inflation by sparking a wage price spiral. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has been down to the picket lines to check out the mood.
Nurses, united, will never be defeated!
An unexpected sight. Nurses not soothing patients at a hospital bedside, but chanting militant slogans on a picket line. On 2 days before Christmas, in a partial walkout, thousands of them downed thermometers, among them Amelia Trow.
I'm striking today for all of the nurses that have to use food banks because we can't afford to pay our heating bills and buy food. It's unsustainable at the moment.
They've been offered a raise of around 4%, but have asked for something closer to 19%.
Isn't a demand for 19% wildly unrealistic, though?
But right now, the cost of living crisis is untenable. We need to be paid a decent wage.
Nurses' pay in England is below the country's average wage and has not kept up with inflation over the past decade, leading to big staff shortages and more problems for the beleaguered state-run National Health Service. Striking nurses like Rosie Owen shrug off the macroeconomic concerns about a 19% pay hike.
It's going to fuel further inflation. It's going to make the cost of living crisis worse.
You know, inflation is going crazy anyway. You know, if you don't pay nurses and if you don't pay your key workers properly, the whole thing will collapse.
There was much the same message at the next picket line that I visited.
Oi, Sunak, hear us say, we want decent pay!
Border protection officers on strike for 4 days over the festive season demanding higher pay.
What do we want?
10%!
Border Protection Officer Dawn Poole and some of her colleagues at Heathrow Airport braved the pouring rain to convey their outrage at the government's pay offer.
The offer on the table was 2%.
2%?
2%.
That's with inflation at 10.7%.
Yeah, and if I can put that into context, we've been offered a derisory 2%, which doesn't even cover a monthly standing charge on the energy bill, let alone the hikes in food costs.
Why strike at Christmas, though? Isn't it a bit mean? You've got thousands of people coming home to see their loved ones.
Honestly, we're at this point where we're at rock bottom. We have literally no choice.
In the event, with Army and Navy personnel stepping in to control the borders during the strike, things seem to go quite smoothly at the ports and airports.
Thank you very much.
Meanwhile, outside a sorting office not far from London, this picket line was manned by employees of the now privatised Royal Mail Service, delivering letters and parcels across the country. The company is losing more than $1 million a day and says it cannot afford to award the workers an inflation-matching pay hike. Striking mailman Tony Warner is not impressed either with that or with the government's call to moderate pay demands.
We're suffering down here and they're saying, well, can you please get through it? We can't give you anything because of inflationary costs or whatever. But these people down here, we're all finding it very hard to manage. So the working class are really pushed to the sidelines.
There's more than a whiff of union militancy in the air. The picketers here were playing a hit from the strike-torn 1970s, part of the union, now an unofficial anthem of the labour movement. And I always get my way if I strike for higher pay. With many more strikes expected in the new year, another line in this song may be equally sobering for ministers. Though I'm a working man, I can ruin the government's plan. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up,
this year has been so far the hardest we've ever seen in the industry.
And it's the same story all over the world. But first, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 345 points, 1%, to close at 33,220. The Nasdaq was up 264 points, 2.6%, to end at 10,478. The S&P 500 added 66 points, 1.75%, to finish at 3849. Tesla charged up 8% today, but the electric vehicle maker's shares are headed for the worst year ever, shedding roughly two-thirds of their value. It's a similar story throughout the tech sector. Amazon, up 2.9% today, has so far lost about half its stock value in 2022. Meta, the parent company of Facebook, added 4% today, but over the last 12 months has seen its market value fall by about two-thirds. And Alphabet, parent company of Google, which added 2.8% today, has dropped almost 40% in the past year. Bond prices rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.82%, and you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. For almost a month, AI enthusiasts and just the generally curious have been experimenting with ChatGPT-3. Some have fed the AI chatbot prompts to write essays, poems, songs. Others have taught it to engage in role-playing games. Michelle Huang is a creative technologist and has been working with AI for years. She took an earlier version of the ChatGPT technology and trained it to think and write like her younger self. Michelle, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. It's really great to be here.
So walk me through how you trained this AI chatbot to engage with you as if you're conversing with your inner child.
Of course. So for the OpenAI GPT-3 chatbot, younger Michelle is trained on these diary entries. So I put in diary entries from the age of 7 to 18. I kept diaries for a really long time and then ended up creating a chat prompt where I had lines from a present Michelle. So I was able to ask my younger Michelle questions, and then the AI essentially just populated the younger Michelle text for what she would have theoretically answered based off of the diary entries that I was able to give her.
Can you describe these diaries for me?
In essence, they're remnants of my childhood. I feel like it covered anything from, you know, seeing my crush at school and, you know, talking about like small heart palpitations that I had in class, to, you know, like really questioning, like, I think this was around age 10 to 14, but really questioning like, hey, like, what is happiness? Like, what things mean a lot to me? What kind of life would I really want to live? And so it really ranged from philosophical questions to everyday mundanity.
What were some of the responses that you got back from the AI? Like, did they feel like how you remember being as a child?
Yes. And I think eerily enough, in some ways, I felt like it was talking to a more authentic version. Like I was speaking directly to the inner world of the younger Michelle. And so, like, I think it's interesting because I think the conversation that I would have had with my younger Michelle self versus the chatbot that was trained on my younger Michelle diaries were actually a little bit different. But I think I was able to get to a more authentic version of her, interestingly enough.
Would you be willing to read me one of your questions and maybe some of the young Michelle responses?
Of course. So when I had asked her which was more important, freedom or love, young Michelle responded that she thought both were important, but if she had to choose one, she would say love is more important because it can help us through any situation while freedom can be sometimes lonely. And I was like, whoa, that directly hit me in the heart.
You posted this project on social media and shared your experience, and those posts went viral. That's certainly how I saw it. Why do you think people on the internet were so interested in your experience with this technology?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because I feel like, you know, a very normal person in the sense that I don't feel like I really did anything that was on the frontier of AI research or, you know, discovered anything new. I kind of just remixed this application of AI into a very personal way. And to me, I think it resonated with a lot of people because I think there's a lot of collective healing that is happening right now. I think in general, there's some things related to desire of human connection. But also I think that as adults, like I heard this quote once that as adults, we're quite similar to the kind of person that we were as a 14-year-old kid. You know, I feel very lucky in the sense that like my 14-year-old self was really optimistic and really liked connection and wanted to, you know, like make friends with everyone. But I do think that like there's a part of ourselves when we're a kid, when we're just at awe with existing and there's a sense of magic that is in the world where we're looking around, there's new experiences. But I think that there's some sort of magic that happens when we're children. And I think there's oftentimes, at least for me, I'll speak for myself, but getting older and becoming more of an adult and like seeing more, but also having more like an experienced view of the world, like some of that magic inevitably feels commonplace. And so kind of like for me, my inner child work is very much about getting back in touch with that magic again. And I think that a lot of people resonated with that.
You started working on this project in 2020, and for many people, it's just in the last couple of weeks that they've even seen this technology, and there are lots of conversations happening about what it means for the future of how we communicate. Where do you see what you've learned from this experience fitting into all that?
It feels to me that AI won't necessarily replace humanity or replace humans. Like, I think that we still need therapists that are very much human to be able to talk to us. But I think that there are really creative ways that we can use AI and these technologies to be able to see parts of ourselves. So in my case, very much a mirror that reflects what my inner child would say or what my angry self would say or what my best, most excited self would say, and be able to understand more about our own humanity and our own varieties of expression using this tool.
Michelle Huang is a creative technologist focusing on human flourishing. Thank you so much for sharing your expertise.
Thank you so much for having me.
Many of the supply chain struggles we've been talking about since the pandemic started have slowly been unclogging and returning to something resembling normal.
but not so much when it comes to certain agricultural commodities. Wheat prices in particular have been very volatile over the past year due to everything from Russia's war in Ukraine to climate change. The U.S. Department of Agriculture predicts that next summer, world wheat stocks will be at a six-year low of 267 million tons. The BBC's Liana Byrne has been speaking to commercial bakers around the world to find out how they're coping.
If you're a baker anywhere in the world, margins are tightening and things are getting tough.
This year has been so far the hardest we've ever seen in the industry.
Asha Batenga has a bakery business called Cakely, based in Kampala, the capital of Uganda.
Hi people, welcome to my YouTube channel, Bake with Asha.
Things that we use on a daily in our businesses, like baking flour, margarine, baking powder, sugar, oil, all that has gone up so much.
Asha says the prices of her ingredients have jumped to levels where, really, she should be doubling her prices. But for items such as wedding cakes,
you can't go back to the client to say, you know what, you have to add in some money because of the changes. You just have to work in losses so that you don't disappoint the client.
One of the biggest expenses for bakeries is wheat. Tom Rees from the international market researchers Euromonitor told me that climate change has already reduced global wheat exports in 2021, pushing up prices. Then, Russia invaded Ukraine, throwing two of the world's biggest wheat exporters into disarray.
The problem now is getting it out of the country. We know that they're no longer in control of the ports there. The only way they can export their wheat is via rail or by HGVs, trucks. But that doesn't allow them to move the volumes that they would have moved before.
Some countries are more affected than others by these price rises. France is famous for the baguette and the croissant. Anthony Courtiel owns a boulangerie in the French capital, Paris. For him, the problem is not the cost of wheat, but the cost of butter, which he says has gone up almost 50%.
We have to rise the price of the croissant, of the pastry, of the pain au chocolat. If I don't rise the price, my business won't work.
He's been lucky, as a lot of his ingredients are sourced locally, and people in Paris tend to have a higher disposable income, so they've put up with the price rises.
Happy or not, they understand why it's more expensive. I think they will understand better if the salary will grow up too in the same way.
In a country like Egypt, which is the world's biggest importer of wheat, it's a different story. Islam Sabri is a baker in the capital, Cairo.
We do grow our own wheat, but we don't get enough of it. We usually get our wheat from Ukraine or Russia or Canada or the States. Some of it got double price now or more.
The Egyptian government has fixed the price of bread to keep it affordable for ordinary people. But for bakers like Islam, that's unsustainable.
I don't know how I'm going to keep like not increasing my prices. I really need to make a living because I also have bills to pay.
If the price of wheat keeps rising, it pushes up the demand for alternatives like rice. Arnaud Petit is the executive director of the International Grains Council.
We know that the rice market is very sensitive to a strong increase in demand,
which would have a big impact on developing countries like the Philippines, which rely heavily on rice imports. There is some good news, though. He says there have been favourable wheat harvests in countries like Canada and Russia, which will boost supplies in 2023. But Arnaud warns prices aren't going to come down anytime soon. I'm the BBC's Liana Byrne for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out. Today, we got news Brazilian soccer legend Pelé has died at 82. He helped popularize soccer around the world and was once the sport's highest paid player. But he was raised in extreme poverty and in 2018 launched the Pele Foundation with a focus on children's poverty and education. The foundation's website links suggested donations to some of Pele's many records: $10 for his famous jersey number, 643 for the number of goals he scored with his team Santos, and $1,283 representing his still standing world record number of goals scored. Here's your moment of economic context. After a week of delays, cancellations, lost bags, and missed vacations, Southwest Airlines says it plans to return to normal operations tomorrow. The company now also has a dedicated page with resources for stranded travelers and others affected by the system collapse, probably more than a million people. Since December 22nd, when bad weather started the chain reaction that created this mess for the airline, Southwest has canceled more than 13,000 flights. John Buckley, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. Amir Babawi is the managing editor. And I'm Kimberly Adams. We'll see you tomorrow, everyone. This is APM.